I'd like to, you know, get back to what you were saying about the business of why you feel so many people, or so few people, that is, generate as much excitement with their music on stage now as did before.
It's a very difficult job to create musical excitement with just a guitar and voice, and maybe just a bass behind the guitar, if at most, you know. Because today, I think more and more people are used to hearing recordings that are just pregnant with sound. I mean, there's so much sound on the records. They like live performances that are the same way. And so you can have a backup band with you, and you can have someone who can supply that full range of sound. You can have a drummer, and you can have a bass player, and you can have all these musicians with you. But to just play with a guitar and voice, it's different, and it's harder to create the tension and the excitement that is necessary to hold an audience that's been brought up on records that are so full of sound, and that an audience that comes to expect so much loud sound in a concert. And I think that part of the ability in holding an audience that these people had, people like the Weavers and Josh White and Brownie McGee and Sonny Terry and Bill Brunsey and lots of people like that, I think the ability, there are a variety of reasons why. The ability comes, first of all, from projecting who they were to an audience. So that by the time the audience went away, they felt that they had gotten to know somebody. They didn't feel that they had been in the presence of a musician who laid down his latest hits or his favorite songs or his best performances.
In other words, it has something to do with the way you felt about the music that you were performing.
Yeah, but there was a total atmosphere of friendliness created between the audience and the artist, because the artists were masters at becoming acquainted with audiences. Concert, say a Josh White concert or a Weavers concert, might start off very cold and take 7 or 8 songs to get off the ground. But by the time it was off the ground, it was off the ground. It wasn't just, you know, Zoom, hit record, everyone is excited. It was, you built from one thing to the next. You built from one plateau to the next. It's a craft. It's not something that you just do. It's something you have to learn over many, many years. And that's the second reason why there are so few people who can make exciting music with just a guitar and voice, because they don't have the time to learn. Performers are so young when they make it that very often, if they've had 6 months to a year or 2 years to learn how to perform on a stage, they've been lucky. They're usually thrust into the spotlight immediately once they have a hit record, or once they find a producer that can make a good album out of the material that they've written. And that's too bad, but that's, I think, one of the big reasons why. Because stage performing is really a craft, and it's something you learn. And it takes years to do it.
And there's no time for it now.
No time at all. And there's also very few places. This is why I play Lena's, because I can try out ideas and do anything I feel like and feel perfectly at home there.
I mean, there aren't many coffee houses and places like that around anymore where you can do this?
There are very few. There are places where people can play, but more often than not, the owners of those coffee houses are very concerned with getting the hippest act they can find, rather than the act that, say, is trying the hardest or playing the best music they can. And maybe it's not commercial music, but perhaps it's very good music.
We get back, I think, again to the whole question of honesty in approach, honesty in music, honesty in what your desire is to accomplish, whether it's a question of making the fast buck or making a good contribution of yourself to
That's right.
art.
That's, I think, exactly right. It's also the commercial aspect of show business has grown in such huge proportions that the turnover among artists within the show business field is very rapid, more rapid than it used to be. I mean, a person had a good start with a couple of very big hit records, maybe, and a good album. He could go for 10 or 15 years, and if he continued to turn out music that was good and it had a certain amount of growth, he would have a career for a lifetime. But today, it's almost planned obsolescence has taken over even in show business, and performers are obsolete almost before they start, because they're required to be trendsetters, fashion setters, not musicians.
Well, how do you resist that? How is it that some performers, some singers, some musicians and artists will resist that and resist the corruption, if, for want of a better word? What is it in a person or in the times or in an area, what is it that will make one person resist that and you know, remain true to an outlook and attitude on art and himself and music and people, and one not?
Well, it's a very, very, very difficult thing to resist.
Money, the fame?
No, it's not money at all. I have more money than I ever had in my life, and probably have enough money so that I'll never have to worry about working for a long time. But I don't spend it, and I live exactly the way I've always lived, and I don't even see it, for that matter, so it doesn't really affect me. What affects you is the way people treat you. What affects you is the way they look upon you. And if you have enough people looking upon you in a certain way, you can begin to believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, you know, not just a weak person that would tend to believe it. Anybody could. I mean, the strongest person in the world, if he's told enough times that he's the greatest thing around, is going to eventually start taking a second look in the mirror, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's difficult to resist. I think it's easier to resist being carried away with your own magnificence if you're aware of what can happen before it happens. I was fortunate to have known a lot of musicians who were successful or famous for very, very, very long lengths of time, and I know how they dealt with it, and I know how the adjustment occurred for them. So for me, it was much easier. Had I known a lot of musicians who were very new, I might have gotten into bad habits about it, you know, and might have forgotten about music. But as it is, I think the important thing is to keep your eyes on what it is that you really wanted to do in the first place. And maybe for some people, what they wanted to do was to be rich and famous, and once they are rich and famous, they don't really care that much about making music anymore.
Uh-huh.
And that can happen, but I don't. I might have been more willing to say that was the case before I had a hit record, because now I'm aware of the pressures that happen to people. I'm aware of what people do to you, and how they treat you, and it's not an easy thing to adjust to by any stretch of the imagination.
I just wondered whether it is, you know, like anything in your background or growing up or, you know, all that kind of stuff, the whole business of having grown up with principles that are strong and that mean a great deal to you,
no.
Which has anything to do with
nothing at all.
Like
nothing? No, I just, in fact, if anything,
shoot out another illusion.
No, I just, you know, I mean, I've always liked playing the same kind of music that I play, and that's what I enjoy. But I could start off tomorrow. I might learn the electric guitar and take a band out with me. I might like to do that someday. I plan to do a whole lot of different things.
Or doing different things doesn't mean you're becoming corrupted.
Well, it could be if people thought that you were doing them simply because you wanted to increase or expand your success.
Right, if you were doing it for that reason, regardless of what people thought.
Yeah, that's right, but it's what people think that is what applies the pressure to you, to the person who's doing it.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's the thing, that people have their own ways of interpreting what it is that you do, and it's very hard to explain or even bother to explain. I mean, I wouldn't bother to explain.
Which leads us right to the next question for you. Question that I had, and my son had, and my daughter has, and my friend. Like, can you tell me?
No.
You can't?
No, I don't.
No.
This is really becoming hysterical. People do this to me all the time. And say, can you tell me? No. You don't even have
to
tell them what it is. I know what you mean.
I don't understand, and I don't think that I'm that far away from things, you know, like, and my kids aren't that far away from things. I'm trying very hard to understand. Like, my daughter says it's just a nonsense song, you know, and if things rhyme, so they rhyme, and just take it for what it is, you know. And my son said, well, I think this is symbolic of, you know, and he's 13, right?
Well, I get annoyed at people who will use the song to reinforce whatever beliefs they have. I'm in favor of people asking me. I won't tell them, but I'm in favor of them asking me what they think it means, because then I think that at least it's open to discussion and they can decide for themselves, like anything. I mean,
right. Well, this is what Jerry said. My daughter, she said, it should mean to you whatever you
exactly,
want it to mean
to you.
Exactly,
and that's the reason I won't bother explaining.
Right, but the thing is that there are some things that sound as though they should be saying something to me. I hear them, but I don't understand what they mean, and I feel robbed because I don't understand. You know, it doesn't have a particular meaning
for me. I couldn't fully
you know?
Explain any song I ever wrote. I couldn't even begin to explain most of them, although some of them are a lot more literal than others. It's a dead-end street for me to get involved in trying to discuss songs, because that's something that sort of prevents the need to have a song written in the first place. You know, if you're going to explain songs, there's no need in writing them at all.
Yeah, well, like that whole bit, you know, in that Times article about Dylan, which, in which, whatever his name was, the writer.
Tony Scaduto, you know, I met him.
He felt very strongly.
He apologized to me for
that. Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Well, I should
think
he would.
He may have been wrong about that. And I said, well, he said, but see, this is the example of another thing that's happened to me. He said, I may have been wrong about that, but I just liked your music so much that I wanted to get you in the article.
Oh, that's great.
And that's the kind of thing that happens. So I haven't been able to really...
That's Zach way of getting in the article.
Yeah, I have no.
No, I think it's very
you can't easy. Say anything to somebody like that. You know, I mean, I just said, well, I appreciate.
Well,
appreciate
except
it.
That you can say, you know, that you're projecting your own, you know,
well,
your own.
Everybody
thing
knows
here,
that. I didn't write the article.
Yeah, but you know, people will read that and take, especially in the you know New York Times, will take it for gospel. There was so much garbage in that article that you know I happen to know was way off base, and I don't know this guy even.
Well,
it's too
bad. I used to like to be in control of things. For a long time, I was really a control freak. I mean, I had to be in control of everything, all the music that I made and all the things that I did and anything that was out regarding. I mean, I wanted to make sure that if people knew anything about me, that it was accurate. I didn't want to have people going off half-cocked and saying things that weren't sensible. But I found that at this point, I mean, I'd have to spend 24 hours a day doing that if I wanted to continue that kind of an attitude. So I've abandoned it. I mean, I just let anybody say whatever they want and do whatever they want. And if they ask me, I'll try to explain something to them if they don't understand it, exclusive of that song, of course.
Well, you sound like you're very much more secure.
But, well, I guess I am in a way.
In yourself.
Well, you can't, after a while, you can't do anything about it anymore. So you either become secure, or you blow your brains out.
Right. I'm glad that you become secure.
That's strange. But the going back to that original point, you know, about the older musicians, the ones that you knew and that I knew. That's the thing that Alina has been able to do with her club, you see. That's the reason I love that place, is that she's given a home to a lot of musicians who couldn't get hired by commercial nightclubs.
She's saved more lives in many more ways.
And I think that a part of that comes from the fact that record companies tend to take over nightclubs after a certain point. Running a nightclub is not an easy business, you know. It's very hard to make a nightclub work. There were people like Lena who started these people off, Josh mm-hmm. White and the Weavers, people like Max Gordon who ran the...
Way back Cafe Society?
That's right. Yeah. I've only just read about those things. I never saw them, but I've always admired somebody who ran a club for his own enjoyment. You know, someone who said, I like it and I'm putting it on in my place and that's it, and if I lose money, I lose money. That's a kind of an approach that I think is very admirable. I think a lot of nightclub owners have decided that that's a good approach, all right, but it's really hard to make ends meet at my club. And if a record company decides to put one of their up and coming acts in my club and do a lot of advertising for me and do a lot of other kinds of things, and they will almost guarantee that I'll have a full house. Well, and why shouldn't I let them do it? And once they do that, then they're owned by the record companies, really. and they no longer have any kind of a character themselves. They just become vehicles for whatever record company wants to put an act in and spend the money on advertising that it'll take to fill the club.
That'll never happen to Lena.
No, it won't. And for that, everyone around here should be very happy.
Because we are.
There are very few places like it.
Yeah, a lot of people who have started there really have gone on to, big things. Tom Paxton used to come here when he was not known at all. Dave Enronk.
I like Dave Enronk.
Yeah.
But you have to have some place where you can fail. Mm. I mean, once you get to a point where everyone's watching you, you can't fail anymore. I mean, the pressure is so intense that you don't have the privilege of being able to bomb with an audience anymore. I mean, they really get hostile with you, say, I spent good money to come and see you and you stunk, in a sense, there are musicians who have been elevated to very rarefied heights. And really, it's a shame because they haven't had the ability, the time to learn how to really play and work in front of an audience. And that don't mean that I have it together by any means either. I mean, I'm trying to learn new things every minute. I sound like I'm sort of saying, well, those guys,
No,
but that's not the way I mean it at all. I'm just as it's just as frightening for me as for anybody else. Even though I may have had a little more time working in nightclubs and concerts, it's different once the pressure is on in that way, because it's a very unique kind of pressure.
Do you have any plans for anything other than, right now, other than just continuing to sing and write and so on?
Well, my theory is that American Pie will self-destruct in about 3 months. And not only will people not want to hear it, but if I start singing it, they'll probably throw things at me.
Like a pie?
Something. And I think a certain amount of backlash can be expected. And I sort of hope for that, because then I think people start looking to other music. But this is a wonderful thing. Like I told about Scaduto, who said he just wanted to get me in the article.
Mm-hmm.
The general feeling of warmth from the audience toward me and from the people even who are journalists and writers and stuff who've listened to my records and been really just nicer than they had to be for the most part. I haven't had anybody try to put a knife in my back yet, although I'm fairly paranoid about it. I guard myself pretty well when I'm talking with people. But you know what they say, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not trying to get you. I found that the audiences, for the most part, have not been tuned in just to one tune. American Pie, most of them have really done their homework. I mean, they know all the songs, and I met some kid who'd been to see 5 concerts of mine in a matter of a month and stuff like that, that makes you feel very humble. Because that's really beautiful. So you try to do the best you can, because there are people that really like what it is you're doing, and that somehow you're bringing something nice into their lives. And I remembered how much the musicians that I liked made my life bearable. So it's really a good thing for me to be able to do a little bit of that for some other people.
That's very nice. That's very nice to hear.
Well, records meant a lot to me. They still do. I like records and people that make music. It's nothing. It's sort of a selfish thing. It's to want to be in their place,
Well, we all have a selfish desire to do something we like to do.
Yeah, what can we do?
How long have you been involved in music? Since you were a little
kid? I could carry a tune pretty good when I was about a year old, and sing songs and stuff. So I was sort of a natural singer when I was very young. That's say with me. I had an ego identity as being a singer all my life.
Hmm. Were there musicians in your family?
No.
Before you?
My father was a salesman. Hmm. Mother was a housewife. They didn't do much of nothing.
That's too bad.
Except try and keep me out of people's hair. But that was the singing part of it was always very much a part of me. The playing didn't come along till I was around, I guess, 13 or 14, and I heard Buddy Holly. And I was really into rock and roll when I was in junior high school and early in high school. And his music inspired me a great deal, and I decided that was enough. I had to learn how to play the guitar, and I did. And I was in an electric band for a while. And then all of a sudden I heard harmonies and singing, the Weavers and some other people, and folk music was just about happening then. And that was the first time I heard another kind of music that I really liked, and I started getting into that. And I really, really clutched hold of it very hard and stayed with it for a long, long, long time. And only recently have I begun to delve back into the rock music that I used to like. And actually, I sort of explode with 1,001 different directions all the time. I'm always listening to millions of different people and sort of absorbing and giving out what it is that I can of their music, because I really find a lot that I like. There are very few artists that I like all of, but there are a whole lot that, there are very few that I like all of, and there are very few that I don't like a little bit of.
Yeah, do you ever listen much to any jazz, any jazz guitarists?
Yeah, I like Monk. Thelonious Monk, yeah. I like, and I listen to Django Reinhardt quite a lot. I like his music very much.
Okay, I was just listening to a tape that I had of Lonnie Johnson just before I came over.
Oh, yeah,
here.
Right.
What a fantastic guitar player this guy was.
He was an incredible guitar player. And in fact, I got into a long discussion with Brownie McGee about him when we were up in Toronto. He was coming in to play the Riverboat, and we were talking about Lonnie Johnson. I also got a hold of a Leroy Carr record with Scrapper Blackwell and Josh White backing him up.
Oh, wow.
Performances in like 1935 or 6. And I'm very partial to that record.
Is that an available record?
Yes.
It is?
Columbia's.
On Biograph? I don't
it's also
know.
On it's the one on Columbia, too. I don't know if they're the same tapes or not, but...
Oh?
Columbia's really
I don't have that
flipping one. Out, man. They're releasing tons of old blues masters.
Oh, beautiful.
They had a...
Oh, that's great.
A 10-record set of Bessie Smith that they've been releasing over the last year.
I've got three sets out, and I have them.
Well, you're up to
right?
four now. You're missing
one. I'm missing one. I have to get out. You know, Lonnie Johnson was, we had in Schenectady for a short while, we had a coffee house, and he appeared here about, what was it, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, something like that.
Probably 3 years before he died.
Right. He was a beautiful guy.
Of course, Brownie McGee and Sonny Terry are originals. And, most people, again, this is the attitude, you know, performers are deified very quickly once they're not around, but there they are. I mean, they're working every week, and there should be a whole lot more people seeing them. I was at Carnegie Hall, and we saw Chuck Berry and Jerry Lee Lewis at Carnegie Hall. These are Chuck Berry is really one of the most incredible innovators. I mean, he is rock and roll for me. There isn't anybody that embodies it so totally as Chuck Berry. His particular groove was really the whole groove of the 60s, that laid-back, incredible groove that he had. And there were empty seats all over the place in Carnegie Hall, and he just gave the best performance I've ever seen, and I mean it. I've never seen a better performance than the one he gave at Carnegie Hall.
Well, I guess what happens to audiences with music as well as anything else is that they're hyped up to one thing or another. They're sold one thing. Something goes out of style and something else is newer and greater.
Style is the important word because music has been co-opted by Madison Avenue and by the people who lead us around by the nose according to what they consider to be fashionable. And as a result, people don't think for themselves really as much as they might. And they
I agree.
They really don't.
I think the emperor has no clothes on is the best motto of the century.
Well, if he does, there's certainly flared pants and wide tied.
No, really, this whole business of being led around by the nose and being told what to like and what to read and what kind of music to react to and all the rest of it's so maddening to
me. Well, it becomes more of a problem when you have an insecure group of people that you're doing it to. And
I would say most of the people are
insecure. We're a very insecure nation, right? I would think, for the most part, and very susceptible to being to feeling out of it. And so there's a real need to feel, to belong.
Yes.
And I think that that they've really latched on to that need and milked it for every cent it's worth. It's a shame, because there's a lot of good music that people don't really train their ears to hear, because it's a whole world in your head once you've learned how to hear music. And it takes years, it doesn't happen overnight, but once you've really learned how to hear it, you learn how what you hear relates to you. And so you can say, well, it's fine music, but it's not for me. Or you can say, that's lousy music, and it's not for me. Or you can say, that's fantastic music, and I love it. But you can differentiate, and you don't have to be told by anybody. But there's another thing, too. You can't really write off the success of a lot of people to Madison Avenue, just as you can't say that it's 100% them. It's somewhere in the middle. There's something happening when somebody is as big as the Beatles or Elvis Presley or Frank Sinatra or Dylan or any of those people, or the Stones or people like that. There's something happening. And if you go see them, you'll walk away and you'll know what it is pretty quickly.
Right, I agree. There's something definitely happening there.
There's a lot happening there.
Madison Avenue doesn't own and rule the whole world. I mean, the trouble comes when you have really fine groups like the Beatles and so on who will make a success, and then you'll have Madison Avenue trying to, like with all the television shows, you know, duplicate it and put
out a whole bunch of them
over and over again and milk it
until
it's dry.
It's duplicating it where it comes, duplicating it. And that's a very mathematical concept. That's a very, very, very uncreative, unartistic concept. Right. You don't duplicate something that's creative. You make something else that's creative. Right. But these people are intellectual and emotional dullards for the most part, who have to, you know, somehow fill their lives with the charisma of other people, because they really don't have anything that they can do, and so they've got to spend their time trying to duplicate what someone else did or find someone who can copy it. And
well, between that and the, you know, worshiping of the almighty dollar, this is what's going to happen. And I think that big money thing there is something important to consider.
Yeah, money is is definitely a factor, especially in this society. Of course, the whole environmental crisis is an economic derivative. That's a function of economics from the word go. The poverty problem in this country is an economic problem, and it's not economics in the sense that poor people don't have money. It's a problem in the sense that some poor people don't adapt to our system, and so therefore they are discarded just like a tin can or an empty bottle. And most of the time they're discarded into the Hudson River, which is the garbage can for a lot of tin cans and empty bottles. Again, another economic imperative, and it worked there. I mean, the river isn't useful anymore. It doesn't carry goods. It doesn't make money for us, so we'll turn it into a sewer. It's cheaper to make it into a sewer. And all this kind of pragmatism, this kind of turn-of-the-century pragmatism that we started out with in the 1890s and the 1900s of William James and people like that, who taught us that if the system that works is the system that you use, don't worry about aesthetics or what's good or what's natural or what's organic or what's moral or what's anything else. Just if it works, use it. And
you use it to death.
And it backfires on you. And, of course, that's what we're now experiencing. And we are at this moment, and the last 10 years is the beginning of it. But I think we are in the middle of actually changing our national philosophy, the philosophy inherent in our national thrust in the American mind. That's a very important thing to even see or live through, because it doesn't happen but once, maybe a century.
Hey, you don't feel like playing? playing or something like that, do you?
Sure, we can play, I guess, a song or two.
That might be nice.
Jack, you want to